Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi there, I'm Janet. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what is a podcast?
It's like the radio, but there's no music, and literally anyone can do one at any moment about any subject. And there's a billion of them.
Sounds great. Hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today we're talking about episode 102, Flying. In the aftermath of the chaos, Eleanor tries to avoid suspicion. Michael is distraught and believes he's made a mistake in his first neighborhood. Tahani puts together a group of volunteers to clean up the neighborhood, but anyone who participates will miss out on Flying Day. Chidi volunteers Eleanor, but Eleanor hides trash quickly in order to fly, which causes a trash storm, and ultimately Chidi refusing to help her. Eleanor feels guilty and cleans the entire neighborhood herself, so Chidi changes his mind. The cliffhanger of this episode is Eleanor receiving a mysterious note under her door that she doesn't belong in the good place. This episode features guest cast Alan Rachel, Amy Okuda, Susan Park, Jorge Diaz, and Steve Berg. And today my guests are casting directors Allison Jones, Ben Harris, and the writer of the episode, Alan Yang. Allison Jones, Ben Harris, Alan Yang, welcome. Everything is fine.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Also, thank just you. Want to say, amazing hearing Mark just read that intro. That was a first take, guys. No editing on that. Just amazing elocution.
I appreciate it. Does it bring back any memories? Do you now recall the episode?
I recall the episode. Yeah, also, thanks for that recap. I was just telling these guys, it feels like we did this so long ago, because since then we did the second season. I was telling them I remember the episode I directed season two, mm-hmm. and you know I also work on some other shows, so I think since then we did season two of Master of None, and then season one of this new Amazon show that's not out yet, but so thank you for that recap. Otherwise, man, I'd have no idea what's going on.
Of course. So I guess to get us started, Alan, you had been, you know, you were in the room for season one?
I was there for a lot of it. So the way that sort of happened was, I'd finished season one of Master of None, which is a show I did with Aziz Ansari, and then I came back to L.A. You know, we shot that show in New York, and I have a bungalow on the Universal Studios lot with Mike Schur, the creator of The Good Place,
yeah.
and my good friend. So we were both writing stuff in the bungalow, and he was working on a show, and gradually, you know, as we'd walk to go eat lunch or whatever, he would start giving me bits and pieces about the show, and he's like, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? And I would give him an opinion here or there, and he's like, oh, that's interesting, that's interesting. Then he pitched the whole pilot to me. I was like, wow, that's really good. And then eventually he's like, what if you helped out on it a little bit? I was like, okay. And he's like, what if you were in the writer's room a little bit? I was like, okay. And he's like, how about you write episode two? I was like, okay. So yeah. Suddenly I was on the staff. So yeah, it was really fun, and I was excited to help out.
Now, what were the marching orders following the pilot? Because obviously the pilot establishes a bananas world. And what was the goal of episode two? I mean, you had to, you know, pay off that she found herself there incorrectly.
Well, the whole season, I would say, was kind of broken as this very cohesive, almost movie-like single narrative. And that is so much of it comes from Mike's brain. You know, he had the pilot. I believe he pitched not only the pilot, but a good amount of the whole season when he pitched the show. Mm-hmm. So when he came into the room, it was a fun group of people, a lot of old Parks and Rec people. You know, I worked on Parks and Rec for the whole run of that show as well. So it was a lot of old friends. And, a lot of it was in Mike's brain. So he sort of had kind of the ending, which is, you know, crazy twist ending. Mm-hmm. And then along the way, it was very important to him, you know, some of the inspirations for the show. And I think he said this before. Were some of those Damon Lindelof shows. You know, I think he's buddies with Damon now, so like Lost and The Leftovers and stuff like that. And so each episode, it was important not only establish the characters, and there's a lot of character comedy like there was in Parks and Rec and The Office, but a lot of cliffhangers. And so the cliffhanger at the end of episode two was, you know, I think the start of many, many, many cliffhangers to come.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Cliffhangers including some brilliant cast that were discovered, found, searched for, gathered by Allison Jones and Ben Harris. Part of the magic, I think, of these people is that they weren't household names prior. These were people, I think specifically of the character of Jianyu, later Jason Mendoza. That's a person we have to buy as someone that could be a silent monk, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If had that been an actor that we had seen on The Office or Parks, mm-hmm. you'd go, I've heard that person talk before. He's going to talk eventually, right? It's the gun over the fireplace or whatever. Mm-hmm. Tell us everything that goes into finding geniuses.
The writing, first of all.
Okay.
It starts with the writing, period, in every occasion. Secondly, there's a lot of legwork involved where you're meeting a lot of, you do what's called a breakdown and you send out to agents a description of the character and you read many, many, many people hoping to find a new face. In TV pilots, that's always the best thing to do. Mike Schur loves to do that. Mike Schur loves a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
That one required a lot of legwork and a lot of pre-reading, a lot of guys. And I was not sure of many of the future actions of these particular characters, especially him being a silent monk.
Right.
This one was fun because he was actually supposed to be an idiot. So it was really funny to read them and then have them do the stupid dialogue, mm-hmm. which was truly funny. We had about 5 great guys for that. Ben, and I remember reading Manny in our office and Jordan Rodriguez and all these good guys who once they opened their, they looked pious and serious. Rene Gobet, looked pious and serious, but then they could do the dumb really well, which is always a delightful thing to cast.
That was the stuff about not only, I don't always want to be a DJ in Jacksonville.
Oh my God.
Maybe I'll be a DJ in Tampa.
Yeah, we heard that a lot. Yeah, we heard a lot of those. I don't know if you were in on the, you weren't in on the pilot edition.
No, not for this show.
No.
For other shows I've been
with
you
guys. It was terribly funny, and we went with a lot of different, diverse choices, blah, 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 but he really wanted someone to believably be a Thai monk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just delightful having to find someone who could get the comedy and also do it without seeming fake.
Now, Alan, do you remember at all if you put anything in the stage direction? At one point, still as Jianyu, he comforts Ted silently. He comforts the character of Michael and sort of puts his reassuring hand on. Were there any thoughts that you offered that character of like what he means to be saying silently?
I think there was a lot of stage direction for Manny because he didn't have lines for a long time. So
right.
I think people were putting stuff in the script to give him stuff to do. But, you know, he also he made that character something really great, especially, you know, after the reveal happens. And man, it was really fun writing those dirtbag Florida lines. It was a lot of, and later the Jacksonville Jaguar stuff and
the Bortles stuff.
Yeah, the stuff that happens in season two, which was really funny because then the Jaguars got really good.
They got good.
The butthole was my favorite.
Yeah, exactly. And it ended up in Manny and Joe Mandy going to Florida, going to Jaguars games in the playoffs.
Right.
Which is
crazy.
I saw that.
Just a delight to write for him. And working with him on set was great. You know, season two, I was on set more. So it was really, really great to work with him.
It deserves lauding, his ability to, you know, convey so much silently. Because it would be tempting as an actor, I can tell you, to really ham up those lines and sort of be doing a lot of facialness, you know, as though you're saying, like, this bank is being robbed, please call the police. You know, like, trying to convey a lot with your eyebrows. And he was so subtle and great. About some of the other characters, it's my understanding from Mike that you saw everybody in the world for Janet. It could have been a child. It could have been an old person. Is that true?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, just for Mike, we probably auditioned 50 people.
Is that right?
And that's, you know, and then we'd also pre-read just Allison and I in our office.
It's also years of trying to find funny women who didn't have to be gorgeous, with all due respect to Darcy, because she's pretty. We didn't have to have the funny, gorgeous woman. We didn't have to have we could just have the woman who was the funniest.
But a very
so we thought that would be easy, and it wasn't easy.
It was not. It was actually
because there were so many good women.
Difficult role to cast.
Oh, I can't imagine. Mm-hmm. It's my understanding that from Darcy that it the breakdown didn't even include sort of a Siri or Alexa kind of.
They didn't want anybody to know any of those.
That it was
points.
Robotic.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But oftentimes a breakdown includes like gender and an age range kind of thing, and that wasn't you were saying you were told to go find
it,
what?
It was pretty. All
funny.
Over the yeah, it was just we were just looking for funny.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And for us, that's a dream.
Yes, that is ideal.
So we were like, "Can we bring in 10 more women for you, please?" Yeah, and out of that group, we have cast a lot of the other people on the show too.
And
just because we've saw Mike always remembers who he likes, and
I think
we'll use them again.
With the pilot, Mike had written dummy sides, fake sides for.
Little bits of script that aren't really going to be in the show.
And with Janet, instead of saying Alexa, he had her being I think it was like an operator.
A helpline.
A helpline. And that was, I think, how he tried to sort of get the Alexa or Siri.
We even brought in J.J. Tota, who then went on to star in NBC's Champions.
That's right.
And he was hilarious. And Mike was going to use him for something, but I believe that's a part that possibly you got instead.
Is that right?
Yep.
I like
one of the bad guys.
I'm happy with the recasting. So it's my understanding as well that Jamila, I know that she was a BBC presenter, but not an actor prior to this. Had you been aware of her prior?
Oh God, no. That was a tough one. That was pretty specific. A British, Indian. Beautiful actress. And so we did a breakdown and read quite a few women. And she came in on a Saturday because in pilot season, you're frequently working on Saturdays. You can read people on Saturdays because they're not working on other things.
Oh, wow.
And she came in and she was this giantess personality-wise and physically. And I think she intimidated everybody in the waiting room. And she was great. And I think she freaked out everybody when she first auditioned. Mike was like, whoa. And then it was basically, how do you say no? To Jamila, because she was delightful.
She is. She's a force of nature.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's hard to know where Jamila ends and Tahani begins.
Yeah.
Because in the show, she knows everyone famous. And then in real life, she like...
Same thing.
I know. Yeah. I directed this Jay-Z video last year, and I was talking to Jamila about it. And she's like, oh, I know Jay and Beyonce. And then I went to this party, this Oscar party that Jay-Z and Beyonce threw. And I walk in, Jamila's there.
No way.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I'm like, oh, there you are. She's like, she knows everybody there. She's like,
didn't know that.
Boyfriend is James Blunt, the singer, and like, yeah, she's regularly hanging out with these people, so all right.
And I believe she told me this. I think it was her first audition, like for
I didn't know, I don't know what a presenter is. I always am asking my British friends, what is a presenter, and do you look down on them acting wise? And they're like, yes, we do. I asked this great British casting director, Lucy Bevan, do you know Jamila Jamil? And she said, I looked her up. I think she's a presenter. And I don't even know. There are so many of them on British television.
Right.
But she is instinct. Her timing is incredible. Her comedy timing is incredible.
She's also fearless. Like, I saw her interviewing Russell Brand, and she mopped the floor with Russell Brand.
Yes, I'm sure she
did. Which is not an easy task.
And she has more of an Essex accent. She has a great, like, London, East London type of accent, naturally, I think. And so she copped the posh accent for... Good place, and it really works.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what the reason was for why she has the British accent, though, on the show, and nobody else does.
There is some in-universe lore for that, yes. There's an explanation.
I know is an explanation.
I think it's if you want to sound like that. I think the theory was she wanted to keep it or something.
It's like mentioned.
They
address it.
Because we interviewed some great British actresses for that, over there and here. There's a number of them, and they were great. But she was just... a force of nature and funny and sort of shocking. And she's pretty dirty in person. She's pretty dirty mouthed. Yeah, potty mouthed. Yeah.
She's a bit of a dude.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's why we hit it off so well immediately. I mean, all of these people are delightful. We talked before we began recording that
you know, Mike has a policy, like Mike curates just great people, cast and crew.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
There doesn't appear to be a lot of drama. William Jackson Harper, how did he come across your desk?
Same thing.
Yeah, he was out of New York, though.
Yeah, his agent taped him in New York.
Did you know immediately?
No, never a shoo-in. I have
is
to
that
say
right?
that that's is that spell a, that myth. For me, it's
any...
never a shoo-in.
That's fascinating.
Ever. They'll say it is, but it never is.
And
if a director goes, that's the one I want, then it's probably going to tank.
That's a kiss of death? Really?
I don't think the kiss of death, but I don't ever think someone's a shoo-in. I never would have thought he was a shoo-in for that. And Mike and Alan, you all see what you want, what you like in the character, and then how you can fit that into the world that you're creating. William Jackson Harper was just a damn good actor when he came in. Really good. He had some stiff competition, too.
I would say, besides Ted and Kristen, everyone else, all those other roles that we would actually test and find a new face, they were all, it was not an easy decision.
No, Mike, he was tortured a bit.
Yes, very much so.
Because we had some good choices,
After the test, I think it was, you know, Mike was...
He had us over there one night to talk about it, and we couldn't help him
like
on that one.
It was... Yeah, it was late at
you
night.
You might say a cheaty level of indecision, agonizing, causing
really
chest and
Thank
stomach
you.
Pains.
Completely. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, William's so skilled as an actor. Like, you know, he's able to do the dramatic stuff and the comedic stuff. It really sort of, you know, working with him reminded me of Adam Scott on Parks and Rec, where he's really able to do the straight man stuff, but also just be so, so funny.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's really been great in the show.
Mike is always willing to see someone who is not particularly right for the part and who may not knock you out at first. And then you think about it and he's like, that's who I want to write for. I have to assume writers look at this and say, who do I want to write for?
I always feel like the best stuff is when the actor's own personality starts imbuing the character and starts informing the character. Especially in comedy and especially in television, where it's a long developing role. And you've seen that in a lot of the stuff that I've worked on, stuff with Mike especially, but you look at how Nick Offerman informed Ron Swanson, you look at how Chris Pratt informed Andy Dwyer and all of the actors on that show. But as you're doing 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 episodes, you would be a fool not to draw from the characters' experiences. And that's how it was on Master of None, too. And these are all sort of shows in the same family. But, yeah, I mean, those characters are just the actors on some of these shows.
I agree. So you just always in TV, find those new faces.
Yes.
Just find the new faces. And the payoff is much, I think, much bigger creatively and also for an audience.
It keeps it from being one note, I suppose. You can, especially playing someone dumb or, you know, an Offerman character of like a grumpy separatist, you know?
But yeah, the specificity makes it real, right? And the specificity makes it real, and the realness makes it funnier because there's nothing better than the real stuff, man. There's nothing better than the real life experiences. So I like meeting with actors and talking to them about their lives, and it really informs a lot of the stuff that I've written.
I try to have the role fit the actor, not the other way around. They don't try to squeeze the actor into what they have in their head. They're open to, I mean, the Judds of the world and Larry David and Mitch Hurwitz and Alan Yang and Aziz and Mike Shore and Greg Daniels. It happened in the past, the casting of the pilot as well. They see what they have there and then how they can work them into the role, vice versa. They don't care about line readings. They want someone who's going to be good to write for, who sort of is fascinating to watch, and who's just inherently funny in any different way they find funny. Inherently funny.
Rewrite to the person.
William Jackson Harper's not funny the way that Ted Danson is funny, but he's
completely
funny.
Different. I think about Will that you believe he's having a stomach ache. He's not something he slips into. It's like he looks tortured.
His agony is
his agony is palpable through the screen. And
while the role of Chidi and Tahani and Janet, those were all three had such stiff competition, but it's very difficult to imagine anybody else now.
Forget it.
Yeah, you can't imagine anyone.
I would think
Fat Janet is everyone's favorite character.
Oh, I hosted an Emmy panel the other day and never got to this, but on my list was to say, like, I adore Darcy. I love Janet. I love Bad Janet.
Yes.
I mean, and for her to get to sink her teeth into something like that, like,
And I'm sure the writers love writing for Bad Janet.
Idiots and mean people are always more fun to write.
I think it was in the episode in season two that you directed that we did a Sean and Bad Janet did a no-look high-five hand slap that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
We did a couple wonders, too. Yeah. That was fun.
Yeah.
I remember getting Mark to do that.
Mm-hmm. Pretty great. Alan, do you share Mike's hatred for Florida and Arizona?
I don't know what's up with that, man. I think it's fun because Florida's one thing, but also just jokes about Arizona. You don't see that many of them, so it's nice to get rid of. Although I did watch this other thing this other day where Charles Barkley was making fun of the food at the Phoenix Suns Arena.
Oh.
It was very, very wow. specific. But it's funny, you know, like, because you want to – I feel like one thing you want to do is play some jokes where they ain't, you know? It's like mm-hmm. Arizona jokes, that's pretty – Florida jokes may be lower hanging fruit, but it's more fun to do original jokes than to play on well-tread ground.
I feel like the audience's imagination could fill in some blanks after the pilot about how bad a character on Earth Eleanor Shellstrop was. Was it difficult? What other things did you consider? How did you arrive at like her ditching her duties as a designated driver over and over again in these flashbacks?
Yeah, it was a real push-pull because that's the kind of thing that a writer's room is good for, I think, because you want to hear people's opinions on how far to push the line. And, you know, that first season, I think I was always pushing for Eleanor to be a little worse, a little worse, a little worse, you know, because there's more comedy that way. And you want, you know, also for the eventual twist to work, you want her to be really bad. And but Mike has a really great instinct, which I think was borne out in Parks and Rec and somewhat on The Office, too, where, you know, he has just this fundamental humanistic sort of optimistic, generous view of humanity that I think comes through in all the shows he's created. And I honestly, like, that has been influential on me as well. I'm a very optimistic, happy person, as all these guys know. And so that comes out a lot. But it's not always common in comedy, you know? It's,
right.
It's the common thing to do in comedy is to make your people real
assholes.
If they're despicable, they're despicable.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And it's just somehow it's a little easier to write sometimes. So to make people good people. So that, I don't know. There's always a push and pull in a writer's room about how far to push the line, right? It's the same, like, how dumb do we make Andy on Parks? Or how dumb, you know, it's like right. that kind of thing where you talk about it. Right?
There's a fun bit at the bottom of this episode 102 where it appears as though she's learned her lesson and is cleaning up the neighborhood in secret by herself. And then, of course, she's instructed Janet to put the garbage in someone else's, Antonio's bedroom or whatever it was. Pretty terrible. Eleanor struggles to be a good friend to Chidi, as we will hear in this clip.
Tell me one fact that you know about me. I mean, we spent the whole day together. You must remember something. What country am I from?
Is it racist if I say Africa?
Yes, and Africa is not a country. I am from Senegal. Do I have any siblings? Where did I go to college?
Trick question, you didn't.
I was literally a college professor. Do you not remember one single thing about me?
Dude, things have been nuts around here. I bet you don't know anything about me.
You were born in Phoenix. You went to school in Tempe. You're an only child. Your favorite show is something called The Real Housewives of Atlanta. And your favorite book is Kendall Jenner's Instagram feed.
How did you know all that?
Because you are constantly talking about yourself. You are the most self-obsessed person I've ever met.
You should see Kendall Jenner's Instagram feed.
Hey, this is my fear about you, Eleanor. You are too selfish to ever be a good person.
Well, I think you're wrong.
What country am I from again?
Sensodyne.
That is a brand of toothpaste.
This clip comes from episodes found on Amazon, Google Play, and iTunes, and watch recent episodes on the NBC app. Did you receive promotional consideration from Sensodyne toothpaste?
Lifetime supply, baby. It's just every day. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, Sensodyne.
It's got to be such a fun puzzle to try to, you know, have her try to improve and fail so miserably over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing that I think Mike is really skilled at doing is you want there to be change in the characters, but you can't progress them so rapidly that you're left with nowhere else to go. And one thing I think he's been really good about doing is having characters grow and change over the course of a season and then still having room to progress. And that's really difficult. And I think season one, the plot moved. It moved really quickly, and that is not easy to do. So
it's got to be difficult to accomplish because, as you say, you do want them to progress not too fast, but you still want to be ahead of the audience. You want to surprise them.
Yes, and there are a lot of charts and graphs in the writer's room. Is that right? There's more charts.
How many writers are there? Who's in the room?
Man, season one, God, I don't even remember. Probably like 10 or so. I could be wrong. Okay. I don't remember how many exactly, but it's only 8 to 10 or something like that. And there literally was a graph of like a chart showing the four main characters and just how they were torturing each other, and because the eventual twist that they were in the bad place was, oh, how is each one specifically torturing someone else? And there's a lot of talk about, circles of hell and all that stuff, which is really crazy. I don't think it happens in a lot of sitcom writers' rooms.
I would imagine it
a lot
doesn't.
Of talk of Aristotle and Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, John Rawls.
Now, did you have any background in this prior?
Sounds a lot of fun. I took like a class or two in philosophy in college, but I didn't remember any of that. Who remembers anything from college? You know, I was a biology major. I don't remember anything. So yeah,
I would guess that Mike Schur remembers a lot of things from
college. He was reading a lot of books, man. He was reading a lot of books in that bungalow. He gave me some packets. I was like, yeah, I'm going to read these.
What goes into casting The Afterlife when at this point in the show's trajectory, we all believed that it was indeed the good place and it was, a utopian society full of frozen yogurt. So you want it to look like Planet Earth, presumably. What were you offered as guidelines for that?
Funny.
Okay.
Funny. And my Ben and my instincts are always to go with people who could do more than what they're given in the first episode, because these people all do come back.
Sure.
And they all have sort of a comic identity. Susan Park has her own identity. Amy Acuda, her own identity. Mm-hmm. Steve Berg, all good improv people, all definitely good improv people. John Hartman, the one who plays the guy asking her for money in a flashback, and she says, smell my farts
my
or
farts.
Something. Yeah, eat my farts. Great, because they have a lot of reactions to do as well, which is hard to do. And everybody that Mike seems to pick that we like to bring in is, including yourself, sir, mm-hmm. Is a great reactor as well. Yeah, which I think also helps Kristen and Ted, but it also defines the character. And The Afterlife, I think, was all sort of... I, of course, probably didn't remember as much as Ben did that they were actually demons.
So you did know that?
Yes.
You knew.
We knew.
Yeah, we knew, and I guess I knew. And with a few lines, somebody who can make a difference and somebody who is cheerful looking. I literally, truly, sure. Yeah,
well,
cheerful looking.
Well, I think at this point...
Because Jorge and Steve both... A cheerful couple.
Susan Park and Amy Acuda. I think that's funny was first and foremost. And then second, I think at this point, the audience doesn't know yet that they're demons, right? And so I think we were looking, or I think Mike was probably looking for that they're coming with some positivity and,
sure.
Levity.
This happens later, but you definitely see it with Tia Sirkar, that she, comes in... saying like, Chidi, don't. And then when he goes, Vicky, stop, like she can turn and be like,
definitely.
Oh, man.
Yeah, definitely.
It's really satisfying.
That's what Darcy can do.
Oh, for sure.
Even in like episode 3 where she just, Michael had told her not to be flirty with somebody and she turns all pouty and nasty. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you found that improvisation is something new over the past 10 to 15 years in casting that you like, it's a different skill set?
100%.
It's fairly recent, right?
I would say since I started working with Judd, Judd sort of brought that into the fore in my, career. I would say that used to be you could deliver a joke, and if you went off the lines, people were horrified.
Right.
Like, oh, my God, he can't remember the lines.
That was the case in I've lived in Hollywood for 17 years, and I can remember, I come from the Second City, I come from an improv background, and I would spice things as I saw fit, and some people would go, were you handed new pages?
Exactly.
how dare you sense.
Yeah. I never thought that was going to transpire until I was doing one pilot where Amy Sedaris put herself in Tammy Chicago, and she ad-libbed, and she was funnier than anything that was written. Mm. And the late, great Chris Thompson said, I like that girl. She's funny.
Yeah.
I was like, but she didn't stay to the lines. Nope, she's funny, and she got the part. And that was probably 25 years ago. But I think Judd, with the onset of hiring people like Steve Carell, where they're funnier than anything anybody could write, definitely started the trend in my minimal casting section. Now everybody wants to know if they can improvise, and most people can.
Right.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
In comedy.
And I'm thankful for it, because I think it does, yeah, as I can tell you as an actor, it's a quicker way into showing the writers and producers and directors, mm-hmm, what I might bring to the role. Forget what's on the page right now, but this is how I find funny. Mm-hmm. And here's something that I hope you can rewrite to at some point.
Exactly. And tying back into what we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm, about writing towards the actors, certainly, mm-hmm, for the larger roles on Master of None, mm-hmm, we would do the scenes, and then we would just have a scenario and say, yeah, like, okay, you are hooking up with Aziz, mm-hmm, and the condom broke. Now just improvise a scene and, mm-hmm, just do it for 2 minutes, three, mm-hmm, minutes. And
see what you find.
Just, yeah, exactly. See what kind of person that is. And then if you end up casting them, like we ended up casting Noelle, mm-hmm, we just hung out with her a lot and tried to rewrite for her. So I think it's just so valuable, because you just know more about the person. It's not the case with every role. You don't need it for every role necessarily, but sometimes if you got those Gatling guns, use them. You know, you'd be a fool not to let them go in some scenes. You know, they didn't do it in, sure, every scene, but some of the scenes it's like, hey, let's do one where you guys are a little looser, and you know, they gave us stuff that we, again, could never have come up with on our own.
In the writer's room, did you have lengthy and epic conversations about what heaven might be like, what perfection might be like? Because I don't know that, I feel it must be fairly universal, because it definitely strikes a chord with me. I would love to fly.
Yeah, I think flying was always, well, there was at one point, I believe, the episode was going to be about gardening. And we're like, no, it's not gonna be about gardening. That's crazy.
That's not
yeah, 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 exactly. So like, whatever, it's flying. Like, everyone wants to fly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there's some pretty, look, the some of the difficulties with a show like this, where your world building is, man, there, because there are no limits, you can really talk about it forever. It can be anything.
Sure.
So that in some way, sometimes the constraints help you, right? Because you can just spiral off into madness. And so yeah, I mean, totally.
Art direction and set direction.
Yes.
I mean, kudos to their art director in this.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I would love to live in that place where they live.
Me too.
I would love to live in, I would even
the clown
take
house?
Yeah, the clown house. No, I would.
You mean that town
take
square?
A lot of Jamila's, yeah, furniture. Yeah, Tahani's furniture.
Oh,
for,
well,
sure.
I mean, that's an epic mansion.
Yes. Yeah. But as opposed to most television shows, this one is really a product of some incredible visual imagination.
And Mike talked about that in the last episode of this podcast, to, mm-hmm, say that it was important to them, as in the writer's room, to exploit the infinity possible. You know, that they, mm-hmm, wanted everybody to be in stripy clothing and there to be giraffes walking through and madness, mm-hmm, you know, shrimp falling from the sky, because you have that ability. So pull that trigger.
Yes, mm-hmm, it's kind of like the promise of the premise, right? If you're going to do a show like this, you know, make use of what you have. Otherwise, it could just be another show of people sitting in an office or friends hanging out watching TV.
Right.
So.
And I think another example of the brilliance of the balance in the show is that you have that, you know, unlimited anything that you want. And then the specificity of Eleanor's thing that brings her joy being people puking on roller coasters, or that, you know, cups, to-go cups where the lid fits so tightly and doesn't leak at the seam. Like, that's so earthbound and specific.
That's my favorite thing of the show in three seasons, because I come out of my favorite coffee place, Go Get Him Tiger, and I have drips of coffee all here. And I'm like, why can't they figure out a coffee cup where the water doesn't leak out when you drink it? It pisses me off.
Right.
But I thought that was genius.
Yes, simultaneous.
Was that your thing?
I don't think that was, but it's, you know, a good balance of observational and absurd, right? You want the imaginative stuff,
yeah,
and you want the real granular Seinfeldian observational stuff sometimes.
The observational
stuff. By the way,
stuff.
Great shout out and slam of Go Get 'Em Tiger.
Yeah,
exactly.
You love it and hate it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But also, for example, great slam and shout out of season 8 of Friends too.
Yeah,
I mean, that stuff is great about that show.
Yeah,
yeah.
Another thing that I love about this is that early on it establishes so much about Eleanor. I think that she is a person who will say, in my defense, and then say something about herself completely damning. You know, like, in my defense, I did it because I'm selfish. Right. Yeah. Is basically, you know, where she comes at this kind of
very
thing.
Little self-awareness. Also, by the way, very different from Kristen Bell in person.
Oh, yes, yes.
For sure.
That's an example of the character being different from her.
She is fairly saintly.
Yeah, she sets a good tone, her and Ted both, of really just being super professional, generous, and kind, and you can't say that about everybody. So I really, really want to shout out those two. No slam.
Only positive.
I want to shout out to you, Mark.
Please.
Just as an attention to Mike Shore's appreciation of humor, you tested for, and I didn't know you until we tested you for the cop role Brooklyn Nine-Nine in the pilot. And you were outstanding. And it was another thing where he talked and he cheaty-like talked and talked and talked. Do we go with Joe or do we go with Mark? Do we go with Joe or do we go with Mark? Either way. And he basically extrapolated what your character would become in the first couple seasons as a cop and what Joe would become. And he went with Joe for whatever reason.
Because Joe is Charles Boyle.
Right? Yes.
I mean, there's no other.
Exactly.
He's the cheaty. Like, there's no other way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then he started using you all the time.
Thank you.
He did not remember you, and you were one of the rare things that comes in, someone who's you've not known before. You were in your early 30s or mid-30s, and you freaking killed it.
Thank you.
Yeah, but it was a totally different version of the character.
I will tell you that it's true. I tested for the role opposite Joe Litrulio for Charles Boyle on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and did what I can do. Like, that character was written as kind of sad sack, kind of schlubby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I am C-3PO and can't do that. It'd be foolish for me to try. You know,
and he said that you were the opposite of how he thought of that role.
Mike Shore wrote the kindest email to my then manager and said, just want to let you know, Mark couldn't have done anything different or better. He is just 180 degrees from how the character's written. But we kept bringing, like, and my manager forwarded it to me and said, I don't get these a lot. Like, Mike's a special dude.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mark, you were Mike's favorite actor. You're in everything he's ever done. I'm pretty sure if he did a movie next year and it was between you and Daniel Day-Lewis, he'd be like, Mark, man.
Yes.
Mark's my man.
I'm sorry.
Mark's my dude.
What movie are we doing next year?
I don't know.
I'm available.
I bet he would, though. I bet he would. He loves
that's
you, man.
So kind.
He loves you.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for being here today. We like to finish off with a segment that we call What's Good, something that makes you happy, a charity you support, the feeling of otters holding hands, that sort of thing. Anything come to mind? Something positive, something optimistic, something Mike Shore?
My little niece, Marianne.
Oh, that's nice. How old is she?
She just turned 2.
Very cool. Yeah. Has she chosen a college?
She's between Harvard and Yale.
Oh, okay. She can commute.
Let's see if Alan has anything to say.
For you, anything come to mind?
Yes, the instance where in the horrible fires we had just north of California recently, and that man jumped up and down and risked getting on fire himself to save the bunny.
That little bunny.
That killed me.
There's
a
video.
I thought that guy was heroic.
It was on a roadside. I think he had gotten out of his car to rescue a wild hare. Right,
he couldn't prevent himself.
Right.
He saw that little hare in pain, and he rescued it.
I love it.
Yeah.
Alan?
I got something way more indulgent. we were talking about it right before we started the podcast. There's a restaurant in downtown L.A. called Major Domo that my friend Dave Chang does, and Ben was talking to me about it. So, go there and get the lamb or get any of the large format dishes. Make yourself happy.
Yeah,
make yourself happy. Do something good for yourself.
Treat yourself.
Yeah.
Allison Jones, Ben Harris, Alan Yang, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mark Evan Jackson.
Thank you very much.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Now go do something good.
Hi there. The podcast is over. I think what I'm feeling is sadness.
Oh, don't worry, Janet. This podcast is the most perfectly engineered invention since the paperclip.
Fun fact, the man who invented the paperclip is in The Bad Place for tax evasion.
It's available on Apple Podcasts and all major podcasting platforms or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop saying podcasts.
Hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Written by Lizzie Pace.
Music composed by David Schwartz. Yay.